Now moving on, rapidly we have Dr. Ferdinando Sardella, who's come to speak to us this afternoon. He's at the University of Uppsala in Sweden.
Just a couple.
Yeah. And he's also a research fellow here at OCHS. And for several years he's been working on various projects. He's recently completed a PhD on Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, and I thought it was published, but it was produced so well that it was published. But and at the moment it's in the process of being published. It will be published in due course. And since that time, he's been working on a project on the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition in Bengal, and he's hoping to develop that project further. And today he's going to speak to us on text migration, translation, and modern reception of the Bhagavata Purana in Bengal and beyond. And I very much look forward to what you have to say.
Thank you. Thank you. First I would like to thank Professor Gavin Flood and the staff of the Oxford Center for giving this opportunity to present my project and ongoing research. And this paper is really a work in progress, because it's part of a chapter on an edited book on the Bhagavata Purana by Kenneth Walpi and Ravi Gupta, and published by Columbia University Press. So it's really based on my own doctoral research that has been introduced and co-authored with Abhishek Ghosh, who is a doctoral student at University of Chicago, studying with Wendy Doniger. And also this, I take the occasion also with this paper to inaugurate a new project at the center called Bengali Vaishnavism in the Modern Period, which has the purpose of exploring the development of Chaitanya Vaishnavism in various cultural, popular, institutional, textual manifestations, both in Bengal and beyond, from the 18th century to the present. So, hopefully there will be many years of development of this project and it will become fruitful in many ways. So the Bhagavata Purana has endured for centuries as one among the more significant texts of living Hinduism. During the second half of the 20th century, it migrated beyond the shores of India and is today not only translated and read in over 20 different languages, like French, German, English, of course, Italian, Russian, and so on, but also highly revered by a worldwide population of both Indic and non-Indic Bhakti practitioners. Considering this, it is curious to note, thank you, that from the mid-18th to the mid-20th century, the specific period of British rule, the Bhagavata Purana was attacked by Christian missionaries and colonial culture in India, but also consciously neglected or held in low esteem by many members of the Hindu and Bengali middle class, who are the focus of this presentation. The key to understanding this somewhat puzzling contradiction lies in exploring the reasons for its negative reception in Bengal during that time among the middle class, called the Bhadralok. Bhadralok, yeah, you're familiar with that. Lok is people, Bhadra, gentle. And in examining the contributions of the three historical figures from this class, they were responsible for its migration, first to Western Europe and the United States, and then to the remainder of the world. To this end, we begin by examining how the Bhagavata was thus received, and briefly continue with the history of its movement to the West after World War II. It was in the late medieval period that the Bhagavata's description of the life of Sri Krishna became a prominent feature of Bengali Vaishnava theology. This was, among others, due to the efforts of Sri Krishna Chaitanya, born 1486, considered by his followers to be the combined manifestation of Radha and Krishna. A primary aim of Chaitanya, according to traditional sources, was to enable ordinary persons to rise above their attachment to the temporary world through the development of unconditional love for God, the highest expression of which he found in the village girls of Braja or Vrindavan between Agra and Delhi, the direct participants in Krishna's sacred dance, the Rasa Lila. For this and other more esoteric reasons, Chaitanya promoted the three forms of religious practice. The first one is public singing of the names of Krishna and dancing in time, Sankirtan. The second is privately chanting those names in a more concentrative mode, Japa. And the third is constantly meditating on the Bhagavad's description of Krishna and or his avatars. In Chaitanya's view, anyone that participated in these practices would experience the ecstasy of loving God and eventually achieve the highest liberation, that is, entry into the eternal lila or play of Krishna in the spiritual world. Over the next several centuries, Chaitanya Vaishnavism continued to grow in popularity until by the end of the 19th century, it had become the preferred religion of approximately, here's numbers difficult, one-fifth of the population of Bengal, according to the census carried out by the British, in various institutional and non-institutional forms. By then, Chaitanya's contribution had become widely acknowledged, and the Bhagavatas Krishna narrative had become deeply embedded in the cultural and religious fiber of eastern India, Indian regions such as Manipur, Tripura, Orissa, and Bengal. During the period of the British rule, however, the particular conception of God conveyed by Chaitanya Vaishnavism was severely criticized by both Westerners and the Western-educated Bengali elite, becoming one among the conflicting factors involved in the cultural tensions and religious transformations of the time. In a sense, this outcome was inevitable, since Bengal, and especially Calcutta, was arguably the foremost loci of India's initial involvement with Britain, and was thus heavily exposed to processes of modernization and transformation that profoundly affected the economic and religious foundation of its indigenous society and culture. Bengal in the 19th century had come under the influence of the Victorian period's contempt for so-called idolatry and sexual expressions, as well as its esteem for science and rationality, attitudes that were largely adopted by the new indigenous intelligentsia, the Bajalok. Most Bajalok had been educated in Protestant, Catholic or colonial institutions, not only of course, but in many cases, and many were under the employ of the colonial administration, exposures that had inclined them to challenge traditional beliefs and practices in unprecedented ways. As a result, many came to perceive the deity of Krishna and the Lila in Vrindavan with the gopis as indecorous, contemptible and morally degrading. Krishna's amorous play with the gopis and with his queens in Dwarka is treated in detail in the Bhagavad Purana. In the spiritual drama of the text, Krishna dances and enjoys in the village of Braja with his loving servants, the gopis, who are beautiful young maidens that just happen to be married to other men, a matter that has been a source of ethical questioning within Hinduism for centuries. The concern is even addressed in the 10th volume of the Bhagava itself, where the narrator Shukadeva Goswami suggests an answer that has been elaborated by subsequent Vaishnava commentators and is here paraphrased as follows. Just as fire can consume, transform and purify unlimited quantities of contaminated material, so can the infallible absolute absorb and purify all amounts of apparently contemptible deeds. As such, the supreme deity, Krishna, remains in this narrative, remains uncontaminated even when he acts in ways that are considered immoral for the fallible beings of this relative world. In keeping with this understanding, Shukadeva Goswami warns that those who attempt to imitate the activities of Krishna, even in their imagination, do so at their own peril. This notwithstanding, and in some measure due to the influence of Western Protestantism, rationalism, and modernism, the Bajalok generally tended to perceive Krishna's amorous Leela as a source of embarrassment, particularly as depicted in popular and left-hand tantric culture. Although in its original dress, Vaishnavism had a profound philosophical basis, over the years it had divided into three general forms, none of which were very appealing to most of the Bengali intelligentsia. The first was its popularized form, which they considered to be sentimental, morally weak, licentious, and mostly the religion of the ignorant and illiterate lower class. The second was its caste-oriented form, which they considered to be elitist, nepotistic, socially callous, and far too old-fashioned and out of step with modern times. The third was its mystical ascetic form, like the Babaji's, the ascetics, which they considered to be too otherworldly. The self-righteous behavior of caste Brahmins, the exploitation of women as wives, prostitutes, or widows, the lack of learning among Vaishnavas of lower castes, and the leaning towards sexual practices among low-caste sections of the Vaishnava society were condemned by the Bhadralok. The Bhadralok generally rejected the amorous Leela of Krishna not only because of a passive assimilation of Victorian Puritanism and Western ideas and literature, but also because of a new indigenous modern sensibility that tended toward rationalism, the questioning of traditional authority, egalitarianism, and inwardly asceticism. Perhaps the contribution of the British was that their presence gave the Bhadralok the courage needed to challenge what most Hindus took for granted. Even in the account of the court case, which I will discuss just next, it was noted that it required tremendous amount of courage for the defendants to stand up against established gurus and sannyasis. The flavor of these times is nicely captured in the following account of a widely publicized 1860s court case that attracted the reform-spirited sympathies of the Bengali Bhadralok. The court case was about a guru in the Vallabha Sampradaya that was accused of having sexual intercourse with the wives of his disciples during the first night of their marriage, the Prima Noche writes. In the reports we read, the disclosures in the court startled the outside world. They were revelations of a theology the most hateful, a morality the most outrageous and filthy. In his lengthy Supreme Court judgment against the plaintiff, the Vallabhacharya Vaishnava Guru and his movement, Sir Joseph Arnold declared, "It is Krishna, the darling of 16,000 gopis or shepherdesses. Krishna, the love hero, the husband of 16,000 princesses, who is the paramount object of Vallabhacharya worship. This tinges the whole system of Hinduism with a strain of carnal sensualism, of strange transcendental lewdness." So, very hard condemnation. In keeping with the judge's conclusions, many Christian missionaries viewed the worship of Krishna as an evil that needed to be curbed as part of a new civilizing project, an important aspect of which was the replacing of indigenous religion and culture with Christian values, English education, and Western ideas. For their part, the Bhadralok were interested in developing rational interpretations of Hinduism that carefully avoided any tinge of erotic mysticism, and in their writings made sure that this understanding would find no place in the teachings and practices of their various new religious institutions. To further illuminate the manner in which the Bhagavata was received by the Bhadralok, we will here briefly explore the background and perspective of three major figures of this period. The first is Ram Mohan Roy, born 1772, who arguably inaugurated the religious modernization of India. The second is Bankim Chandra Chatterjee, born 1838, a civil servant and writer who significantly contributed to the rise of India's independence movement. And the third is Swami Vivekananda, born 1863, whose non-dualistic reading of Hinduism has tended to remain the standard conceptual lens used to view Hindu traditions among most Indian and Western intellectuals, even to this day, although this conceptual limitation is gradually being overcome. Ram Mohan Roy's father was a devout Vaishnava, and in his early life, Roy's, quote, reverence for Vishnu was so great that he would not even take a drop of water without first reciting a chapter from the Bhagavad Purana, unquote. Over the course of time, however, his study of both Hindu and Muslim thought, his interactions with missionaries such as William Carey of the Serampore mission, and his sustained involvement with the East India Company gradually led him to reject the religion of his father. After retiring from his employment as an East India Company broker, Roy dedicated himself to social, political, and religious reform, challenging key tenets of traditional Hinduism through various publications and letters. Eventually, he founded the Brahmo Sabha, an institution intended to promote a form of Hinduism that was both universalist and rational in orientation. The relative success of the Brahmo Sabha, especially among the Bhadralok, is to some degree indicated by the fact that the renowned Tagore family assumed its leadership after Roy's death, and it transformed it to the Brahmo Samaj. Ram Mohan Roy argued against Hindu practices of image worship, condemning them as idolatry, and he critiqued the Bhagavata with particular reference to the Vaishnavas in his work Goswamidhar Sahitya Bichar, Debate with Vaishnava Leaders, the Goswamis, In his booklet, he claimed that the image of Krishna of the Chandogya Upanishad was not the same image of Krishna that his contemporary Vaishnavas worshipped, which he regarded as degraded. Bhagavad Gita, which he saw as Upanishadic in nature, gave far greater stress to knowledge than to blind devotion or bhakti. He likewise also challenged the doctrinal basis of the Vaishnavas, who claimed that the Bhagavad Purana was a natural commentary to the renowned philosophical text, the Vedanta Sutra. In his book, he states, here is a quote, "After stealing the clothes of the cowherd maidens, the gopis, Krishna asked them to become his servants, to do whatever he asked them to, and personally come to him naked, smiling, in order to get their clothes back. Why don't educated people objectively analyze whether Shruti or the Sutra of the Vedanta supports such immoral acts?" Ramohan's influence grew in the subsequent decades among Bengali intellectuals, among whom Bankim Chandra stands out. Bankim Chandra came to prominence by covertly resisting the British Raj through his novels and articles. Like his predecessor, Bankim Chandra advocated for Hindu reform, and he drew similar conclusions about Krishna Lila, but with some notable differences relative to his aims. Whereas Ramohan Roy's intention was to purge Hinduism of Krishna Bhakti, Bankim Chandra aimed to construct a new ethical image of Krishna, whom he viewed as a potential hero and rallying point in the struggle for political emancipation and independence. Among the historical relevant Bhadralokas discussed thus far, Swami Vivekananda is the one most known to the West. He promoted a modern form of Vedanta, inspired by Shankara's classical thought, which rose in the early 20th century to become the standard understanding of Hinduism among many Indian and Western intellectuals, remaining so to some degree even today. Stated in very brief terms, this understanding is as follows. You're probably already quite familiar with it. In its highest and most fundamental essence, Hinduism regards the transitory world of individual sense, form, and personality to be ultimately unreal or non-existent, considering the ultimate absolute to consist of an underlying, all-pervading, and formless oneness known as Brahman. This understanding is in opposition to the more commonplace belief of the general masses in India, among Hindus, in the worship of personal deity forms of gods and goddesses, which are regarded as real in various degrees. Unlike Ramohan Roy, however, Vivekananda believed that image worship and theistic Vaishnavism, as presented in the Bhagavad Purana, played an important indirect role by helping Hindus to prepare their minds for the ultimate realization of Brahman. So although, as indicated above, the attitude of most of the Bhadralokas towards the Bhagavata Purana was generally dismissive during the 19th century, there were contrary voices as well. Among those who deeply studied the Bhagavata and promoted its relevance in a modern context, two figures stand out: Kedarnath Datta Bhaktivinod, born in 1838, and his son Bimal Prasada Datta, known as later on as Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, born in 1874. That was the theme of my thesis, Life of Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati and his works. The two Dattas strived to legitimize the Bhagavata in Bengal and contributed in various ways to the later migration of the text to the West, a task that was actually carried out by Abhay Charanaravinda Deya, known later on as Swami A.C. Bhaktivedanta, a Bengali Bhadralokas from Calcutta who became initiated by Bhaktisiddhanta. He promoted the translation, migration, and mass distribution of the Bhagavata in various languages around the world, as I mentioned earlier. It is important to notice, however, the nuances in the contribution of these three personalities here briefly introduced. Bhaktivinoda published an essay on the Bhagavata and wrote books on Krishna Bhakti, which he sent to leading Western intellectuals and Indologists of his time, such as Monier Williams in Oxford. His book is found still in the Indian Institute Library. However, he never ventured to publish the Bhagavata itself. His son, Bhaktisiddhanta, on the other hand, published a Bengali version of the Bhagavat that included his own commentary. But in a mission to London and Berlin in the 1930s, he placed far greater emphasis on the life and teachings of Chaitanya than in the one of Krishna and his Lila. Swami Bhaktivedanta, in contrast, made the Bhagavata the core of his presentation of Chaitanya Bhakti in North America and Europe. What follows is a brief overview of these events. Kedarnath Datta Bhaktivinod eagerly engaged in the intellectual debates of his time and was a prolific writer. He spent his early life in a rural setting and moved to Calcutta later in his teens to gain a Western education. During his years in Calcutta, he became active in student intellectual circles and interacted with some of the most well-known figures of the so-called Bengal Renaissance. His initial relation to the Bhagavata was somehow typical for mainstream Bhadralok, as presented in his work, The Bhagavat, Its Philosophy, Its Ethics, and Its Theology. I quote here a little bit. When we were in college, says Bhaktivinod, reading the philosophical works of the West and exchanging thoughts with the thinkers of the day, we had a real hatred towards the Bhagavata. That great work looked like a repository of wicked and stupid ideas, scarcely adapted to the 19th century, and we hated to hear any arguments in its favor. Greedily, we pored over the various commentaries of the Tattva Buddhini Sabha that was founded by the Tagore family, which later became the Brahma Samaj, containing extracts from the Upanishads and the Vedanta, but no work of the Vaishnavas had any favor with us. Unquote. By his midlife, however, Bhaktivinod rediscovered the Bhagavata and studied the works of the Bengal Vaishnava school, which led him to accept Chaitanya as his, in his own words, Eastern savior. Bhaktivinoda's main contribution rests perhaps in his rational systematization of Vaishnava theology. In a Sanskrit Bengali book, the Krishna Samhita, he found parallels between the Puranic histories of kingly dynasties and Western timelines through a method that he named Adunikavada, or modern approach, you can translate. In this instance, he read some of the timelines and historical periods described in the Bhagavad Purana from the perspective of Western historiography, explicitly in order to make them accessible to Western educated Hindus. His basic premise, though, was that this exercise was peripheral and the Bhagavad dealt primarily with the subject of God and transcendence. The colonial Victorian cultural milieu in Britain did not allow much space to the amorous pastimes of Krishna of the Bhagavatam. Recent research has pointed out the pioneering contribution of Bhaktivinoda in introducing Krishna Bhakti to the West. But it is interesting to note, as mentioned earlier, that Bhaktivinoda's presentation of Krishna Bhakti to the West was not in terms of the Bhagavat itself. His strategy was to bring out the Bhagavat in the context of the life of Chaitanya, which he regarded as more relevant and perhaps more agreeable to contemporary sensibilities. According to Bhaktivinoda, Chaitanya was the living embodiment of the Bhagavat. The strategy adopted by Bhaktivinoda was later carried out by his son, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. He encouraged his missionary representatives in London and Berlin to present the teachings of the Bhagavat and the Lila of Krishna as something entirely transcendental and outside the realm of the physical and material world. He regarded these teachings and their application as perfectly embodied in the ascetic and chaste life of Chaitanya. The venture to the West was initially carried out by two disciples, Swami Hridayabhon and Swami Bhakti Pradip Tirtha, under his supervision shortly before World War II. It was actually a third one, who wrote a doctoral thesis at the University of London, Sambindananda Das. He wrote a history of Vaishnavism in two volumes, and the first volume has been published in Madras. Bhaktisiddhanta carefully prepared this venture by arranging for the printing of a volume called Sri Krishna Chaitanya, a lengthy book written by another of his disciples, Nishikanta Sanyal, who was a professor of history at Ravenshaw College in Chutak, under his supervision. His specific goal was to introduce Chaitanya instead of Krishna as the major focus of Vaishnava Bhakti. The book also contained a lengthy introductory chapter that compared the idea of Vaishnava theism with that of the theistic Abrahamic religions. The book was meant to give a new perspective on the study of Hindu theism and bhakti, critiquing a number of negative assumptions held in the West. The mission in Europe dwindled as the Gaudiya Math, the institution founded by Bhaktisiddhanta, broke into two factions shortly after his death. More factions followed. Despite these institutional setbacks, his disciple Bhaktivedanta, who received initiation shortly before Bhaktisiddhanta passed away in 1937, set with very little resources to carry out the vision of his predecessors. However, from the very beginning of his work in the United States, where he migrated in 1965, Bhaktivedanta presented Krishna and the Bhagavat as his primary focus, which was an innovation. Consequently, he named his institution the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Most importantly for our narrative, before reaching the West and during the remaining years of his life, Bhaktivedanta began working on a full translation of the Bhagavat in English, in 12 volumes, which by the time of his passing away in 1977 was nearly completed. This translation formed the basis of numerous new translations in other languages carried out by his movement. Swami Bhaktivedanta presented the Bhagavad as a key element of the practice of bhakti, as well as a way to maintain a strong connection with the tradition. But above all, he treated the Bhagavad adopting a rational methodology, describing and analyzing the practice and theory of Krishna bhakti through in-depth rational discussions. He consistently argued against the most prevalent critiques of Krishna and his amorous sports by the Bhadralok. Furthermore, while he applied a close translation of the text according to traditional hermeneutics and the commentary of Bhaktisiddhanta, his preceptor, he was at the same time innovative. The last portion of the paper will contain a brief analysis of his hermeneutical method in presenting the Bhagavad. South Asian religions have traditionally given ample space to hermeneutics. Newer and newer commentaries have emerged to address the perceptions, concerns, and sensibilities of new audiences at different times in India. Commentaries have also helped to make the text intelligible for those not entirely familiar with the genre or the tradition that the text represents. Bhaktivedanta began translating the Bhagavad in English in the 1950s in Vrindavan, at a transitional period in Indian history, that is, as Nehru pursued the socialistic modernization and industrialization of India, which perhaps inspired Bhaktivedanta's critique of certain aspects of modernity. The structure of Swami Bhaktivedanta's translation and commentary of the Bhagavad was designed to give a sense of traditional authoritativeness. He first provided the original verse in Sanskrit in Devanagari script, a standardized system since the 19th century. He then transliterated the original text in the Roman alphabet with diacritics, followed by a word-for-word translation. He then translated the verse in English and added elaborate, what he called, Bhaktivedanta purports, where he expanded the meaning of the verse and stated at times his own views on contemporary issues, which was a new feature compared to the work of his predecessors. In order to briefly analyze this in more detail, it is important to explore the structure of a traditional Sanskrit commentary. According to Gary Tubb at the University of Chicago, a Sanskrit commentary written in the line of classical works such as the Nyaya Kosha and the Parashara Samhita has five functions. The first is Padacheda, Padartokti, Vigraha, Bhakya Yojana, and the last is Akshepadhana. The function of Padacheda is to divide up a Sanskrit sentence into its constituent words so as to let the reader know the constitution of words, breaking up the sandhi or word coalitions. In Sanskrit, the rules of coalitions apply for all the words in the sentence. In the Bhagavad, if we take the first verse, the Bhagavad, the word Trisarga-amrisha could be broken down into Trisarga-amrisha or Trisarga-mrisha. The first would mean that the world is real, and the second that the world is unreal. The possibility of ambiguous word meaning proves the need of Padacheda. The second function that Bhaktivedanta uses can loosely fit into a feature of Sanskrit commentary where meanings of words are chosen according to the context of the text. Because of the richness of Sanskrit semantics and vocabulary, a single word can mean many different things, and it is the work of the exegete and commentator to select a specific meaning, often following the established parameters of interpretation of the tradition and earlier commentators, and at times expanding it. The third feature of the Sanskrit commentary is vigraha, literally meaning expanded form of nominal compounds. In Sanskrit, compounds need to be unpacked and interpreted. A literal dictionary translation would not be enough. For example, in an instance, the word Indra-ari, which literally means Indra-enemy, could mean both someone that is an enemy of Indra or that Indra is an enemy of, leaving the reader in an ambiguous position. In this case, Bhaktivedanta qualifies it as an enemy of Indra. The fourth function is where Bhaktivedanta translates the verses into whole English sentences in a way that is at times close to the word-for-word original, but sometimes less, becoming more paraphrased. A close look at these translations would perhaps surprise a trained Sanskritist, as Bhaktivedanta at times focuses far more on the overall meaning of the sentence and its role within the larger hermeneutical discourse of the Vaishnava tradition. But this is far from unusual in the Indic commentary traditions. The fifth and last function of a Sanskrit commentary, interpreting the meaning and placing it within the frame of a broader ongoing debate, is quite relevant in relation to Bhaktivedanta's commentary. Gary Tubb explained this feature as such. I quote here, "This part of the commentary is concerned with the ideas contained in the original text rather than with its words. Accordingly, it differs from the preceding four functions. At this level, the commentary goes beyond straightforward exegesis and becomes an argumentative treatise in its own right." The Bhaktivedanta purports engage conceptually with various modern critiques of the Bhagavatam, such as the role of Krishna and his play with the gopis and his queens that were rejected by the mainstream Bhadralok, but also with what the tradition has regarded as its main intellectual antagonist, particularly the Advaita Vedanta of Shankara in its classical and modern interpretations. Furthermore, in his commentary to the text, engaging with 20th century Western philosophy, religion and culture, Bhaktivedanta explored issues such as gender, the role of religion in the modern world, secularism, various contemporary political systems, consumerism, the concept of modernity, and the role and nature of modern science. His gaze toward the contemporary world in a commentary of the Bhagavata is not found in the commentary published by his guru, Bhaktisiddhanta, for example, which was strictly addressing issues related to the text and its intratextual interpretation, and did not look beyond that. I mean, Bhaktisiddhanta addressed this relationship between the theology of the Bhagavats and the modern world in his journals and newspapers, but not in the commentary itself. To conclude, the migration of the Bhagavat to the West and its current translation in various languages around the world represents an important conceptual contribution to modern Hinduism and Bhakti, and perhaps a counterbalance to mainstream religious perceptions of Hinduism among the Hindu middle class and non-Hindu, both in Bengal and beyond. The perceptions of this mainstream, as we have discussed, was constituted by colonial sensibilities, but above all by such transformative and creative figures such as Ram Mohan Roy, Bankim Chandra, Swami Vivekananda, as we mentioned, but also Gandhi and Sarvapalli Radhakrishnan, a scholar in Oxford and former president of India. Their efforts directly, or in many cases indirectly, contributed to obscure personalistic strands of Krishna Bhakti and their literature, such as the Bhagavata, a central and still quite popular text in all Vaishnava traditions of India. The migration and translation of the Bhagavata carried out by Swami Bhaktivedanta, discussed in this paper, is a modern, innovative presentation of a rather traditional voice within the multiple streams of Hindu religions. It is a testimony to the conceptual vitality and inner richness of modern and classical Indic religions, and a further case of one among a number of living Indian traditions that today have reached areas of the world far beyond the shores of India. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Sutton, for a very lucid presentation, I thought. There are questions and points. We've got 20 minutes.
It's kind of a question that takes it a little bit away from the Bengali context.
All right.
Where, you know, the figures you talked about are situated. But given the, of course, you know, a lot of, as you mentioned, a lot of the interaction between British intellectual systems and sort of the new Indian intellectual circles of the Bhadralok happens in Bengal, because that's where the British kind of landed and were so prominent.
Right.
But given the importance of a text like the Bhagavad for like the Vallabha school, and you're sort of the other side of India, of the subcontinent. Are you aware of any sort of similar enterprises happening sort of in those circles? I mean, you mentioned the court case
in Bombay.
Yeah,
right.
But is there sort of in that, or I mean, are you aware of any happening there, sort of in terms of criticism of the narratives of the Bhagavata, but also of sort of a defense of, or sort of a re interpretation or re-examining of the
right. It's a good question. Actually, as I said, this is a kind of a little micro study in one sense, because it's focused on the Badrolok and the middle class Badrolok and their perceptions and sensibilities, but also, as I mentioned here, the kind of mainstream Badrolok sensibilities that were shaped by Rammohan Roy, by the Brahmo Samaj, that had a tremendous impact in India, not only in Bengal, but all over India, and Arya Samaj and so on and so forth. But there is a lot of more interesting stuff which hasn't really been explored properly. For example, in the, just if we go back to Bengal, for example, there is a one research scholar. She's working with Tony Stewart, and together they have created a bibliography of Vaishnava texts in the Bengali libraries in Calcutta. And very little is known about the different groups of Badrolok people who were basically Vaishnavas, and in their own ways producing literature, journals, magazines, and so on and so forth. So we can assume that as much as that was going on in Bengal, we had parallel movements in Maharashtra, probably in South India and in North India, Varanasi, and so on and so forth. But this hasn't really been covered. So this is, I mean, in many ways a case study, but you can, building on this kind of idea and relationship with the colonial environment and how the Badrolok reacted, the Hindu middle class reacted to these different impulses, you can construct a model where this could have happened also in other parts of India and perhaps go in different directions, but still having a section of the middle class defending the Bhagavatam and arguing for, and then others arguing against it in many ways and critiquing it. So I wouldn't be surprised to find a certain kind of similar debates going on in different parts of India. But what I try to describe here is, you would say, like the mainstream idea. The general attitude was to a critique of Krishna and Krishna Lila in the Bhagavata as being irreconcilable, really, with the kind of moral standards that the middle class in India wanted to build up. At the same time, attempts like Bankim Chandra to still maintain Krishna, but just redefining his ethical stature and his ethical profile. So I wouldn't be surprised to find that in other parts of India, but hasn't really been done much on it.
I was just wondering what you thought Bhaktivedanta's reasons were for emphasizing the Bhagavad as opposed to Chaitanya, like
Bhaktisiddhanta,
why he felt?
Well, that has to be an answer which is a little bit speculative, but my impression is that in some ways, Bhaktivedanta did not target Britain above all. It didn't really initially come in contact with the ex-colonial culture that he was very familiar with in India, but he went to the United States, and we can conjecture that meeting the counterculture in the States, which was extremely open to Indian ideas, Indian philosophy, he didn't really have to have the kind of barriers, he didn't have to feel the same kind of reservation that perhaps Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhaktisiddhanta felt in those days, because of the heavy critique of Christian missionaries and various Western intellectuals. So my presupposition would be that he felt much more free and could present the Bhagavata in a completely different light, with free hands, practically, because his audience was open. While in Britain in those days, he would have to break many walls, so to speak, before introducing something which was so controversial. That would be my theory.
What do you think the reason behind presenting Chaitanya's life instead of giving prominence to Bhagavata, the Bhaktivedantas?
Why he would emphasize Chaitanya?
Why did he?
Oh, what do you mean with Bhaktivinoda Thakur, the first ones?
In the Bhaktivedanta.
Yes. He emphasized more Krishna and the Bhagavatam, while Bhaktivinoda Thakur the first one of the three, and Bhaktisiddhanta, they emphasize Chaitanya. Well, the reason is very simple, because Chaitanya's life was very chaste. Nobody could critique. I mean, Vaishnavas were considered to be, because of the Rasa Lila and the erotic mysticism, as someone, people who were generally degraded, morally degraded. But referring back to Chaitanya, who was basically a sannyasi, living a very pure, ethically correct life, there was very little to critique. So that could be a very point of reference. In discussion with Christians, with the Bhadralok, with the Brahma Samaj, and showed them an example of a Vaishnava who was doing in their eyes all right.
Does it mean that he did, he in a sense, purged away this Rasa Lila section, which is controversial one? He did not give importance to, or he did not consider it as important?
Who are you talking with, about? Bhaktisiddhanta?
Bhaktisiddhanta. Because he has to, when he presented Chaitanya.
You're totally correct.
He has to naturally...
Yeah. You're totally correct. He actually never wanted to talk about it. And his the way of presenting Krishna Bhakti was that Chaitanya comes first, and then studying philosophy, and then when that's very clearly understood, and one has kind of matured spiritually, then one can approach the Rasa Lila. But that would be kind of at the top. While maybe in many Vaishnava circles, the tendency would be to start with the Rasa Lila and and neglect the philosophy behind it. So, in other words, he found that the proportion was a little imbalanced. And
how does Bhakti Vedanta, in his commentary, explain this this so-called controversial or Rasa Lila section? Another?
Yes, in the actually
his interpretation. To be precise.
Yes. Well, basically, it was.
I have heard that it is a question of Vedantic interpretation, Paramatma, Jivatma, attracted by towards Paramatma. That is a representation, not the physical or the. That is the way it is interpreted.
Yeah.
Is it correct?
It's correct. I mean, both Bhaktisiddhanta and Bhaktivedanta interpreted the Rasa Lila and kind of Prema Bhakti, the highest level of Bhakti, as a total spiritual experience that doesn't really have anything to do with the material body. And they were in this way indirectly critiquing some of the Vaishnava currents in Bengal. They really interpret the Rasa Lila as a physical experience, as a maybe symbolism of the male and female union, which brings you to in connection with the divine. So they kind of distance themselves from that and envision the Rasa Lila as something purely transcendental, beyond the body and mind. So that was the main understanding, and then addressing the critique in various ways in the commentaries. That was more or less the strategy.
Then I want to say you were also mentioned about Vivekananda, who in he presented a Vedantic one, did not consider this Bhagavata as so important.
Well,
in his lectures, he say Krishna, he advises the countrymen, Krishna, you go to the Krishna of Mahabharata,
yes.
Bhagavad Gita,
yes.
The kingmaker,
yes.
Not to the Bhagavata one. I don't suggest or advise you to, he says in his speeches.
Right, not to go to the
Bhagavata one.
Right.
So Krishna, idea Krishna is to be found in the Mahabharata.
Yes.
Where this is not found. And the Bhagavad Gita. So follow him, make him as your ideal, he says in his
yes.
lectures.
No, this is very common for that period, that the middle class would think of Krishna in terms of the Bhagavad Gita, perhaps, as a kind of moral hero, more than dancing with girls, like that. This is very typical. But Vivekananda, on the other side, he spoke very extensively about Bhakti Yoga,
yes.
And he spoke also very highly of Vaishnavism and Chaitanya. But his idea, Vivekananda, of course, out of the context we discuss, he considered that most of Vaishnavism in his time was degraded.
Yes, he criticizes ridicule the Babaism.
Yes.
Babaji.
Yeah, the Babaji, the false asceticism, and so he as most of his Bhadralok of his time, he wanted to kind of reform, rectify, improve, and but otherwise he saw bhakti, devotion to God and goddesses, as something, as a stepping stone, a stepping stone, yes, on the Advaitic path.
Yes.
And he never spoke really in very negative terms of Bhakti, as Ramohan Roy did. Yes. Ramohan Roy was significantly more critical of the whole concept of Bhakti.
Certainly.
Yes. So. Yes.
I was always under the impression that the main reason why the British did not like the Bhagavata Purana, or and consequently the Bengali Vaishnavas in general, has less to do with the facts you mentioned. I mean, the Bhadralok's education in Protestant colleges and modernism, Ramohan Roy.
Right, all of it, yeah.
But that it just reflected this situation in high caste Bengali society in that time, and because the advisors of the British, most of the, or it's possible, I think most of the advisors of the British were high caste Brahmins.
Oh yes,
and they were Shaktas, of course.
Oh yes,
and the Shakta milieu, it's still sensible even today in India. Looked at all the Vaishnavas with respect, because there are several reasons for it, of course.
Yes,
do not respect caste. Is the most important.
So
do you think that this fact could play some role? I mean, this high caste Shakta Brahmins within the British government service, I would say, helped to shape this bad image of Vaishnavas or Bhagavata in that time.
Oh yes, I mean absolutely. I never really look at that in great depth, but it's very important to this is a further study, of course, which is very important, because the way the British, most of them were not familiar with Sanskrit, many of them did not speak Bengali, so it's extremely important to see what kind of informants they had. And as you mentioned, many of them were Brahmins, both could be Shaiva, could be Vaishnava, but in Bengal, of course, a lot of Shaiva. And it would be very, very important to look closer to what kind of persons came in the position of helping out the missionaries, the colonialists, to understand Hinduism, and study their background, and study the kind of works they were writing, and so on and so forth. If possible, that would be perhaps in terms of letters or pamphlets. On the other hand, it is a little bit difficult. There is a difficulty in general about studying the reactions of the Brahmins to the West, or Western philosophy, or Christianity even, because it appears to me that the Brahmins generally did not they were informing and dealing with the British, but were not really engaging in discussion about Christianity, about Western philosophy in general. They were very much keeping on their own. They were answering questions about Manusamhita, whatever the British wanted to know, but they wouldn't start arguing with them about Western philosophy or about Christianity. And that makes it a bit difficult to really understand what they were thinking, what they had in their minds. But I would suppose that, yes, definitely, it's very important to see, you know, what kind of people they were and their background. And that could have possibly influenced the way the British understood Vaishnavism, because obviously they had very little access to it. There were no translations of the Bhagavad Purana. So it was, and Western scholars have, in general, if you look at Ludo Roche's book about the Puranas, were generally feeling a little scared by the Puranic literature, because it's so vast, it's gigantic.
Mythology.
So
they didn't give any value,
and they didn't take it seriously, basically. But they studied instead the Upanishads, they studied the Vedas, they studied the oldest texts. So because of that, very few people were really looking at the Bhagavad Purana in depth. Westerners, I mean, Western scholars, and that's part of the problem, perhaps.
In that sense, just as you said, like, isn't the question more about the kind of milieu that is developing? It's not about how many informants the British have and from which section, as you know, also, but who is engaging with the larger discourse. On the one hand, it's the whole Western educated intelligentsia who is now imbibing a different set of values altogether. Here it is perhaps very important to remember that even within Vaishnavism there were so many different threads, and upper caste, it's not upper caste Shaktas, rather it's upper caste Vaishnavism or Vaishnavism in fact has its very many strengths, where they enforced caste system so strongly. And so these kind of distinctions perhaps cannot be maintained. Rather, what is perhaps more important to look at is how, in spite of the Brahminical culture being spread in a lot of layers, in the lower ranks, in the villages, or that is why, I mean, even Vaishnavism underwent numerous changes in the later medieval period. And these tenets were continuing even till 19th, 20th century, as we were mentioning. And these were now considered to be the rasa lila, or everything that is, which is now being stamped and, you know, postured as vulgar and therefore has to be cleaned, sanitized. And this overall culture that is coming has to be located in the larger milieu of the change in the value system altogether, in the changes in the educational system, in the interaction between the two different cultures. And there I would like to precisely know, like, how Bhakti Siddhanta's interactions, I think that you brought out so clearly that how the interpretations are themselves changing according to the context and according to the communication factors, like the people with whom they're communicating and how they're communicating and when and in what situations. But how the, as you said, that for Bhakti Vedanta the situation was largely different because he's now opening up in the US situation.
Yes.
But how, once certain things are being set up, he's also carrying the baggage of Bhakti Siddhanta.
Yes.
So how far that continued, and how far in these three figures that you said, we have a different kind of a theological understanding, which would be perhaps existent, and how will you contextualize it?
You mean a different kind of theological understanding?
Yeah, because as you say, you made out certain things very clearly.
Preserved, yes, the early predecessors.
Yeah, and then it seems to be a different, because here there is a juncture in the 19th-20th century. So,
yes, yes.
And then in spite of going back, like when Bhaktivedanta is again opening up the issue, can he really go back to the earlier issues? Or because he must be carrying the baggage of his predecessor.
Yes.
So how is that a continuation?
There are many issues there. But one way to look at it is that to have an understanding of there is a kind of core. These three personalities, figures, they have a certain common understanding of the theology of the nature of Krishna Lila, as I mentioned, as a basically a transcendental phenomenon. But then there is, if you look at the periphery would be in this model, that would be the way you relate that core to the changing environments. It could be India, Bengal, US, whatever. Then there are also elements which they used to preserve continuity. One of the elements were the idea that about caste, for example, that the Brahminical culture is not restricted to born Brahmins. In other words, Bhaktivinoda Thakur's main idea, which he derived from the Chaitanya Charitamrita and deep study of the early literature, was that within Bhakti there is a kind of liberating power, kind of egalitarian power. That means that differences of class are respected in general, but the strength of Bhakti is that you can, no matter whether one is a man, a woman, or Shudra, Dalit, or Brahmin, they're really on the level of Bhakti equal, because what really counts is your devotion to God. And the more you have, even if you are from a low class, the more respect you will get from fellow Vaishnavas. So that kind of breaking of barriers was applied by Bhaktivedanta when he came to the US and met these Westerners, the, you know, hippies, which would be considered outcast in India, I mean, even below that. But then he didn't have any difficulty to really integrate them in a very traditional Vaishnava, Brahminical, Sanskritized system, because of this idea which were being developed and revived by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So you have many of these lines, and then Bhaktivedanta revolutionized the ashram of his Bhaktisiddhanta's guru, which created in India, by accepting women in his ashrams in the U.S. There was an innovation, because he realized that unless women came into the ashrams, the men would not come. So it was an adjustment to time, place, and circumstance. So You can find many of these things, but the fundamentally, I mean, Bhaktivedanta, I think, by studying his work in Bhaktisiddhanta's, they kind of stick to one kind of common idea about what is the nature of bhakti, Krishna, which put them a little bit apart from the way it was understood by the Bhadralok and even other sections of the Vaishnava world. As you have mentioned, there were many, many strands of Vaishnavism, of course, and that was kept them a little bit apart from the others, and from that platform they could preserve a certain continuity and at the same time adjust to different contexts.
So the bhakti has played a common unifying factor.
Yes.
That is the bhakti movement. From the beginning it was like that.
Yes.
See in the history.
Yes, it's
same is the case with the tantra also.
Yes.
It accepts all. So the division of varnashrama is only the social level.
Yes.
And though tantras speak about diksha for everybody, social level the varnashrama dharma is maintained.
Yes.
But not at the religious and the spiritual level. Everybody is welcome.
Yes.
That is the bhakti and tantra, they are both together in this attitude.
Right.
Both, yes.
And if you look at the history, I mean, how bhakti was developed in the 19th, we have to stop questioning soon, in the 19th century, in 20th century, you have this idea of universalist Hinduism growing up. I mean, because the influence of Ram Mohan Roy, Vivekananda, had a very, in many ways, very positive effect on Hinduism, because really introduced the notion that this particular religion is not really a localized religion. It's really meant for all human beings. There is something universal about it that really is applicable beyond the borders of India, which was very revolutionary in terms of the caste system and the orthodox Brahmins. So, and some or other Bhaktivedanta and Bhaktisiddhanta and Bhaktivinoda, they took hold of this idea, which was really developed by the Bhadralok, by Ram Mohan Roy and others, and applied in many ways that one could argue within the context of bhakti. And from there got the strength to really carry to its natural conclusions that even Westerners can become Vaishnava gurus and they can have Indian disciples. I mean, the color doesn't mean anything. Race doesn't really mean anything. Nationality is external.
That is maybe more due to the innate nature of the Tantra and Bhakti tradition.
Yes.
Than to this.
The philosophy is there.
Because their contribution is not much a positive one.
Right.
A negative one.
Right.
So even the Tantra, Agama, Bhakti tradition, it supports.
Yes.
This type of universalism.
Yeah, I'm not saying.
So they definitely derived.
I agree totally with you. I'm not saying that Bhaktivedanta, Bhaktisiddhanta, they did what they did because of the colonial environment or something. All these ideas are there in the texts.
Yes.
But the point is that why extract them at that moment? There must be some conducive environment that allows you to extract the ideas. The ideas are already there. I mean, bhakti is very clearly defined in the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam and many tantric texts. But then, who is going to take them out and apply them in real life? That's a problem. And in that kind of environment, in Bengal, in the colonial period, there was a conducive environment to do that. That's what I'm saying.
In the Shiva Dharma, there is a passage, even a mlecha, mlecha who has a Shiva Bhakti, he should be taken.
Yes.
Be considered.
Yes.
He is one among us.
Exactly.
A clear passage, Shiva Dharma.
Yes.
He is so old as 8th century, 7th
yes.
century.
Yes.
So, yes.
Thank you very much. On that sort of all-inclusive note, I think we should...
Positive.
I'd like to thank you both so much for coming down and talking to us and giving us a very stimulating afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.